Next case for argument is Belansky v. Kane County. Mr. Nagelberg.
Good morning. I'm Sheldon Nagelberg on behalf of Lori Belansky. Seizures can be of different intensities. An investigative stop, which is commonly known as a Terry stop and was recognized by our Supreme Court in Terry v. Ohio, requires a seizure, but the police do not even have to have probable cause to arrest to be able to engage in that particular seizure. And I know that our Supreme Court and none of the other courts have made analogous the expression what stands as in custody under the habeas jurisprudence. I would like to note that in Rumsfeld versus Padilla in 2004, our Supreme Court stated that our understanding of custody has broadened to include restraints short of physical confinement. And the Supreme Court in 1991 in the California versus Hodari D noted that
custody is not a synonym for seizure.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Custody isn't a synonym for a seizure.
That is correct. It is not, but it is my belief that the position taken by...
You're not seized when you're on parole or probation, but you may be in custody because of other restrictions.
That's correct. But
she wasn't seized.
I understand that the subject of seizure, which goes to the heart of one of the major issues in this appeal, has been questioned. And as I conceded in attempting to support Justice Ginsburg's holding in her concurrent opinion as to what she believes a seizure encompasses, in the context that I argued of the uniqueness of what occurs with the advocacy center at Kane County, Your Honor, that it is one building, and in that building there is a shop, and the shop has a prosecutor, the shop has a detailed police officer. And as I stated in my brief, the functions of the prosecutor and the police officer, the functions of law enforcement and prosecution, are so blurred that it's hard to distinguish the role of when an arrest occurred and when a seizure occurred. And I think it's especially, I think it's important, Your Honor, to know that if Ms. Belansky was an adult, given what was known to the Advocacy Center investigators at that time, this case would not even pass muster at a Gerstein hearing.
What does that have to do with seizures? That's what I don't understand. Seizure. I don't understand your Brady claim either. What? So Brady just requires disclosing exculpatory evidence on the eve of trial, right? So what was the harm? So she's acquitted.
Yes, she's acquitted.
So the only harm would be, what, a delay of a few days or something if they disclosed the information earlier?
Well, Your Honor, I think the harm went back to the actual beginnings of the prosecution, and I believe the statement...
Well, that can't be a Brady harm, right? A Brady harm can't arise until the Brady duty is triggered.
Yes, but the Brady duty was triggered from the get-go because of the information.
It can't be. It's no, because they have no duty to turn this stuff over until the beginning of the trial, or you know, a few days earlier, whatever the defendant would need to make use of the information.
Your Honor, I believe with all due respect that this court did rule in a case that, if I may have a moment to locate this, in this court in Jones versus City of Chicago in 1988, stated that the misconduct of officers in fabricating evidence and concealing exculpatory information from prosecutors could have injured that plaintiff if the misconduct influenced the prosecutor's decision to even file charges or take a case to trial. So I would submit that the Brady violation goes all the way backwards to the inception of a prosecution and not just to the eve of trial.
Well, do we know that the prosecutor wouldn't have brought it had he known that?
I do not know that, sir.
So, while that may be the case you're citing, may be relevant in some instances, it's not here because we don't know whether he would or would not have brought the case, right?
Well,
see, that Jones is not a Brady case. There, the police are concealing information from the prosecutor. Right?
Yes, but in my second amended complaint, I'm alleging that the DCFS defendant who was assigned to the Advocacy Center and the Elgin police officer who was detailed to the Advocacy Center were aware of those particular exculpatory facts and concealed that from the prosecutor from the get-go.
Why do you call that a Brady violation? Brady is the duty of the prosecutor to hand over exculpatory evidence.
And that's because...
That's why it doesn't arise until the eve of trial. You're talking about something quite different.
And the reason why I am combining them, Your Honor, and I realize the court is concerned about that, and that is because I pointed out that the whole essence of the framework of the Kane County Advocacy Center combines all of these functions together. It's not as if there is the Chicago Police Department, there are police districts, there are arrests made on the street, and then that information is tendered to the state's attorney's office. It's all in one package, and that's the troubling aspect, where it's different and the roles are blurred from differentiating between these.
Prosecutors are part of the team.
Yes, sir.
And this went out on a 12B6, on a motion to dismiss.
Yes, sir. With respect to the Brady material, I would like to point that when it comes to young children, and Brent L. was 6 years old at the time, there's of a special concern in the matters that I enumerated that I thought were the specific Brady material that...
I wish you'd drop Brady.
Exculpatory might be better.
Very well. The exculpatory...
The argument is concealment, I suppose. These people know what's going on. They conceal it.
Yes, sir. The concealed exculpatory material...
Exculpatory, they know that she's probably innocent, right?
She is innocent. She always was innocent. But when you're dealing with young children, the protocol of interviewing them, the problems dealing with suggestiveness, with any prior contacts the child had with a parent or some other adult figure which could have affected their memory. I mean, at 6 years of age, the ability of children cognitively to be able to think, to answer
but
questions.
But if you think there was intentional wrongdoing, why don't you bring an action for malicious prosecution? If you don't think it was intentional, then I don't know what kind of case you have. If a person is just prosecuted but not imprisoned, then, yes, it's malicious prosecution, right? Isn't that the right way to think of this?
Your Honor, my interpretation of Albright versus Oliver was that I could not frame it in a malicious prosecution.
You bring a state court suit. Illinois has malicious prosecution.
Yes, they do, and I chose not to do that.
What was the allegation of how she came in contact with the 6-year-old?
You mean in the complaint?
The allegations. What brought them together in the allegations?
It was never specified. I do know that.
I couldn't find it. That's why I'm.
Yes, she lived across the street.
Okay. Well, that.
Yes, of course. And I pointed this out, I was concerned that I believe that Judge Zagel made an error in assuming that in Brent L.'s world that the girl who lived across the street, who was my client, was the only Lori that Brent L. ever knew. And that was never pleaded, and I think that was an error for Judge Zagel to assume that And I think that played a key role in the decision of Judge Sagel in agreeing to dismiss the matter. I will save whatever time I have.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nagel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bava.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Sunil Bawe, and I'm here on behalf of the defendant, Catherine Byrne, of the Department of Children and Family Services. And I'm here with Ms. Betsy Flood, who represents the remaining defendants. The judgment of the district court should be affirmed in its entirety because the plaintiff has failed to sufficiently allege a Fourth Amendment violation in her Second Amended complaint. Her claim for procedural due process also fails because the plaintiff was found not guilty at her trial. But on the Fourth Amendment issue, Your Honor, the plaintiff for the first time today has raised the issue that a habeas corpus analysis is applicable to seizure under the Fourth Amendment. And there simply are no cases that have held so. The plaintiff here really alleges that she was charged with criminal sexual assault and sexual abuse and required to come to court to answer charges. And that's what happens when somebody is charged with a crime, that mandatory court appearances do not suffice to form a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. This whole notion of a continuing seizure doctrine, and now the plaintiff has conceded that it is not the law. Only one justice on the Supreme Court has subscribed to it. And in fact, this court has stated that while it's intriguing, that's not the law. The plaintiff has not alleged what the seizure was, that this is nothing more than just a routine juvenile case. That every criminal defendant.
About the second issue, the quasi malicious prosecution, whatever we should think about it.
Correct, Your Honor. And
in
this case, the plaintiff has not claimed a constitutional deprivation of any liberty interest. Because she was found not guilty at her trial, any evidence that would have been withheld or concealed was not material. It made no difference. And in fact, in this case, this trial was disposed of on an identification issue. All the allegations in the complaint that deal with the evidence that was allegedly withheld had nothing to do with identification. It made no difference one way or the other. It had no impact.
I think the argument is her peace of mind was, she was deprived of peace of mind, mental tranquility.
And she may have, but that is not a constitutional deprivation of liberty. And as this court has pointed out, that perhaps there may be a state cause of action that is possible, perhaps malicious prosecution or whatnot, but nothing that should be here in federal court. And because the plaintiff has not suffered a constitutional deprivation of liberty, there's been no 14th Amendment violation, and therefore her claim fails. And if this court has no other questions, Your Honors, we respectfully request that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. And now Ms. Flood will speak on behalf of the remaining defendants.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bava. Ms. Flood?
Good morning. I'm Elizabeth Flood. I'm appearing on behalf of the Child Advocacy Center, the Kane County Child Advocacy Center Advisory Board, and David Berg. I agree with the comments already made that in this case there was no Fourth Amendment seizure. I would like to point out to this court that none of the parties in this case, neither the investigators, the Child Advocacy Center, or the Child Advocacy Center Advisory Board, had the ability to issue the summons that was issued in this case to bring this juvenile to trial. That is within the province of the court and the court clerk under the Juvenile Court Act. So even if she was seized, even if this court were to construe the summons which brought her to court as
who
a seizure.
Who requested the summons be issued?
The Juvenile Court Act states that upon the commencement of a prosecution, the clerk of the court shall issue a summons. Therefore, I believe that it was the prosecutor, the state's attorney's office, who is not a named party in this case, who has the authority under the Illinois statutes to initiate prosecutions, and therefore would have initiated the summons in this case. However, there are no parties of the Kane County State's Attorney's Office who are defendants in this case. Although the plaintiff has argued that there was a blurred line between the investigators and the prosecutors in this case, there's been no evidence to show that the investigators were endowed with any authority, nor is there any statute cited which gives the Kane County Child Advocacy Center itself the authority vested in the state's attorney's office in Illinois to actually make charging decisions. Likewise, in the Brady violation issue, the plaintiff has argued that this goes back to the beginnings of the prosecution, that this evidence, which may have been exculpatory, could have changed whether this person would have been prosecuted. However, again, as there are no state's attorneys who are defendants in this case, it was within the discretion of the state's attorney's office to make those charging decisions. We have no way of knowing what the state's attorneys would have done in this case. As Mr. Behaev has pointed out, the issues in this case, which were deemed or alleged to be exculpatory, all went to the credibility of the witness in this case. This was not evidence which was determinative of guilt or innocence. So we cannot say that the prosecutors would not have proceeded in this case, even had they known about the credibility issues. It's also interesting to note that the plaintiff, on one hand, argues that there is a blurring between the investigators and the prosecutors at the Kane County Advocacy Center. On the other hand, under his Brady claim, he's alleging that this evidence was withheld by the investigators from the prosecutors. He says if the prosecutors would have known this information, they would not have charged. If there was this blurring with the investigators and prosecutors all acting together, it seems that the prosecutors would have known this information. As we are also defending the Kane County Child Advocacy Center and Kane County itself, we would also note that because there are no constitutional violations that have been shown in this case, therefore the governmental bodies cannot be held liable as there was no custom or policy which then created any constitutional violations. Otherwise, subject to the court, I would stand on the remaining of our brief, subject to any questions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Flood. And Mr. Nagelberg, your time expired, but if you'd like a minute, you may have it.
Kane County State's Attorney serves as the chairman of the Defendant Advisory Board, and the Kane County State's Attorney are members of the Advocacy Center. Finally, I know that this court has expressed its doubts on the issue of the concept of continuing seizure, but in the context of a false arrest, no probable cause claim, which is inherent in the claim that I'm making, this court has never fully addressed that. In the Reed versus City of Chicago case, you rejected a malicious prosecution claim where the plaintiff failed to show improper influence or misstatements by the police. And in your Wilkins versus May, you rejected the continuous seizure in a claim of excessive force.
Point. So you mentioned the Jones case. Jones' case, you know, the guy was arrested and jailed and so on. He wasn't just put on trial, but what is the deprivation of liberty here since she was never detained?
She had pretrial restrictions. She had to come to court. She could not leave the state of Illinois without the permission of the court. None of this particular...
So that's a deprivation, that would be the deprivation of liberty that you're complaining about. Deprivation of liberty without due process of law, is that the...
That's correct, that she was compelled to come to court. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much to all three counsel.